All right, let's make sure we are in fellowship here and get back to it, dealing with this matter of materialism, the things it can do, the things that are problematic because of it. And again, we live in a society, in a culture. And oh, by the way, I did, before I forgot, I wanted to remind everybody, the 26th and 27th November, we will not have class for Thanksgiving week. And if you are going to be gone, if some people may leave town before that 24th or not come back till the 1st. If you're going to be out of town the 24th or 1st or not going to be here, let me know if you haven't already. So if we get down to where there's just going to be a few of us, we'll take a break. But other than that, Wayne, I intend having classes both of those days, the 24th and the 1st. All right, so just to remind you about that, again, point F here we're working on. Everybody acknowledges the difficulties of being hungry. Everybody gets hunger, but too few are honest about the difficulties of being full. This has led us into problems in America that are affecting the healthcare system, that are affecting the hospitals, that are affecting 40% of our population. And there's just so many problems that come out of this. It's not just the matter of eating too much. It's the matter of the things that come because of that. So, G here, there are no commands for believers to seek or pursue a life of poverty. However, if believers understood or acknowledged certain spiritual realities, they might not be so quick to seek wealth. Proverbs 30. And again, really, the bottom line in all of this is having the balance in life that God desires for us. And that is to have our spiritual priorities straight first, and then seek to work everything under that. Everything is subservient at a certain level to getting to class and being instructed, to being fed. This is number one, our spiritual food. How many meals a week do you miss? Probably not many. And for us, of course, we've got, when dealing with doctrine, one of the issues, all of us have the coin of the realm, the same coin of the realm is time for all of us. We all have 168 hours a week. And really, at four Bible classes a week, roughly 4 hours, let's say, we'd probably meet a little less than that, but say 4 hours. 4 hours out of 168 is a little over 2% of your time. And that's not asking very much, I don't think. And so, because we do have, you know, and it'd be different if we, you know, if this was just a regimen like the Army, we have four classes a week, you do not miss, you do not deviate, but no, we have vacations, we have time off, we don't try to grind people into the ground. I used to be more that way. I just thought I wouldn't cancel class. I got up and taught classes, I thought I was going to die in the pulpit. I must have had a fever and didn't really realize it, but I was standing up there just sweating, and by the time I finished, my shirt was soaking wet, and I felt like passing out, and then I told him, I don't think I'm going to go second session. I think I'm going to go home. But obviously, we don't want people pushing themselves. You got a fever, if you're contagious, stay home. You're not having to prove anything about how tough you are, about how positive you are. We want you home if you're sick. And so we have, you know, we have holidays and time off, and I don't really want to try to drive the congregation into the dirt. That's not the goal. It is to cover as much ground as we can, cover the things that are pertinent, like these two doctrines we've just done, the apologetic and this one. I don't know that there's any two more pertinent doctrines in America right now. They're all pertinent, you know, all the time, of course. Proverbs chapter 30, though, here, verses 8 and 9. Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. This seems like a wise prayer to me. Feed me with the food that is my portion, so that I will not be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or, on the other extreme, if you give him poverty, or that I may not be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. And so, a balance in life is a good thing. Again, having sufficient money to meet your needs, and again, to be able to put a little aside for savings, and then obviously part of all of that is so you can help others who may become in need, and not grow weary in well-doing. So H, one critical danger of wealth is that it tends to cause believers to focus on their money and details while discouraging faith, rest, and gratitude. Proverbs 11:28. He who trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will flourish like the green leaf. And so, again, the danger of trusting in wealth. In 1 Timothy 6:17, in the New Testament, instruct those who are rich. And again, we have to be careful that we don't want to just define rich as slightly above what I have. That's what rich is, just slightly more than I've got. Because I'm not rich, see. But again, like I said, our whole generation, we were taught to poor mouth it. How you doing? I'm getting by. It's wonderful. It's great. You know, nobody will say they have anything. I mean, I see people, you know, they live in 3,000-4,000 square foot homes. They've got three vehicles and all that. How you doing? I'm getting by. No, you're doing more than getting by. But again, I don't, as a pastor, I have never begrudged anybody anything. I hope God blesses the hell out of you. Literally and figuratively. I pray constantly on my prayer list that you will prosper and be in good health. People say, well, the pastor, he shouldn't have as much. Well, nobody here has ever been like that, fortunately. Well, there were some people here earlier, but they've gone. They've since, you know, when their attitude is, we pay him, don't we? Okay, thanks. None taken. So the fact is, I pray for that all the time. But of course, the soul prosperity is the big thing. If your soul isn't prospering, none of that makes any difference. You've got to have capacity for life and the ability to enjoy it, for one thing. I think. People save and save, and as a matter of fact, when I was working at the pharmacy, of course, it's back. I think I finished there in 97. Yeah, 97. I stopped working there. Worked there from 89 to 97. It was 8 years actually. I thought it was 10, but it was actually only about 8. Now I forgot what I was going to tell you. I would do deliveries. That was how I got started, because you know I just wanted a part time job that was you know. Really didn't have a lot of responsibility. And when I started at the pharmacy, because I just needed a part-time job because I was wanting to study and teach. And so they weren't paying me enough. This is the group that promised me $1,700. And when I got here, that $17 became $7. That made it a little more difficult. But once you're here, what are you going to do? So we got through it all, and God took care of us and provided and everything. But when I was doing deliveries, I got this job because it was easy. He said, can you put soda in a machine? Yeah, can you sweep floors? This is exactly what I wanted. Okay, and you can do deliveries. Yeah, I got a commercial driver's license, in fact. But I just had to drive a car, so it wasn't anything big. But as I would do deliveries, one of the most heartbreaking things I ever come across, I still remember this to this very day, and this must have been about 95. So it's been some time back, almost 30 years. And this couple, one I delivered to, they were in, you know, the typical little things you see out here in retirement communities. They're either small little things that are all, you know, all on top of each other, or a trailer park, or mobile homes, they're supposed to say now, but can't say mobile home park. But anyway, they were in there, and I went in, and I delivered, and he said, well, okay, let me get you a check. And as I was sitting there talking to him, he said, we spent all of our lives working hard and putting our money aside so that we could travel and enjoy our retirement years, our golden years. Well, that's the great American dream. Forget doctrine. But that's the great American dream, isn't it? And guess what? God's not in that, necessarily. I know Americans think he is, but I don't know that he necessarily is. And he said, you know, we sacrificed, we denied ourselves, and now here we are at the end of our life when we should be enjoying life, and we're spending all our money on medicines and doctors. And so, there's no guarantees for tomorrow. And this is one of the reasons why we encourage everybody, whatever applications you're going to make, you better make them. You better get after it. Time is running out. And time isn't just running out. You're getting older. And at a certain point, the body gives out. And this is why you encourage people, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Because youth goes by fast. The prime of life is fleeting, as Solomon says. And it is. It gets by so quick. It just seems like it was not that long ago I was playing baseball all summer. Running around, I can remember 12, 13 years old, just enjoying life. And those days are gone. But I used to think, you know, a three-month vacation in the summer, that wasn't long enough. Anybody get a three-month vacation now? Now, you know, if you get 2 weeks, you're probably fortunate. So but he said, and it was kind of heartbreaking. He said, all we do is spend our money on this and that. And you could tell they weren't enjoying their life. And God gives us all things richly to enjoy. He wants us to enjoy life. So this isn't designed to make people feel bad or put pressure on them. It's designed to help you be the whole kind of person God wants us to be. And that is on top of money. Money's not on top of us. We control it. It doesn't control us. And then using it wisely. And I pray about that all the time too, because if you get some money and have a savings account, what does God expect you to do with it? How are you to be a steward of that? That's part of living the Christian life. So some people say, well, I know I had a friend that was in the ministry. He's dead now, Tom Balding. But his philosophy was, I don't want to die with any money. he said, I want to use my money here and now and lay up reward in heaven, and I don't want to die rich. And he succeeded in not dying rich. I can tell you that. And I don't have any problem with that attitude, frankly. I'm not saying that should be everybody's attitude, but I can appreciate that he had the whole stewardship thing right. That, hey, God, if he's provided. But then you got to watch it, because we want to be generous people. Be generous, ready to share. But then you got to watch it sometimes as a believer, because we get to be do-gooders. Oh, I'm ready to share. I'll give you anything you got, anything you need. Well, God may not want you helping that particular person. This is why you have to being led by the Spirit, prayer, and all of that. Obviously, something where, like we had a hurricane. Speaking of being ready in season and out, I don't know about you, but the last 2 months have been really brutal on me. So I suspect everybody else has gone through the same thing, pretty much. But it's a fight. For a period there of like a month, it was a fight to even get to the study. And that's why I like staying ahead, because if you get into a deal like that, where somehow, and of course I've never had a period like that, where for a month it was almost impossible to get there. So I'm glad I stay ahead, but I've always thought that was a good idea anyway. So be able to still have the stuff they need. So 1 Timothy here, 6:17, be able to have the doctrine prepared, ready to teach. Instruct those who are rich not to be conceited, or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. Why? Because money makes itself wings and can fly away. A bad investment, everybody thinks they're all fine. And everybody was real happy on Wednesday. I don't know if you saw the market or not, but I think it was up like 1,500 points. People made some money on their IRAs and all of that. But that can go away too. We've seen the market crash and go down to half of what it is before. So that can happen. Well, Jesus addressed this issue of earthly treasures and how believers are to relate to them, Matthew 6:21. Nevertheless, some believers wrongly assume that even if wealth has some inherent dangers for others, it does not pose a real danger for them. This is the danger of not seeing the danger, of being on top of these things so that we have the right attitudes and ideas. And again, Matthew, where are we at here? 6:21. Actually, verse 20 is where the thought again. Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And the evil eye, the eye is the lamp of the body. This is the greedy person. And if the greedy person runs around thinking they're okay, if their eye is clear, that's good. The whole body will be full of light. But if it's not, if your eye is bad, then the whole body's full of darkness. And as I was mentioning earlier, too, you have to watch. It's good to be generous. It's good to be ready to help. Also, again, prayer and the leading of the Spirit is critical because, let's just face it, the poor you have with you always. There's always going to be needs. We don't have to worry about that. It's doing what God wants us to do with what he provides. That's the stewardship aspect of all of this. Also, Matthew 19, 23 and 24. Truly I say to you, and of course this really freaked him out, it is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Why? Why? Is it because wealth, there's something problem with money? No, it's because the problem is their faith tends to be in their money or their ability to make it. Their faith doesn't tend to be in God sometimes. And again, I say to you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. And when the disciples heard this, they were very astonished. They were flabbergasted. Certainly, they had the same mentality that many people have. If you're prosperous, it means God's for you. And that means you're a great believer, that God's all over you. No, it doesn't. There are some very prosperous, wicked people out there. And there are some very prosperous, good people. The problem is, the prosperity doesn't say anything about whether or not God's for you. And people wrongly assume that. And we used to have a joke about it back when I was in seminary. Something happened to somebody and some little setback or something, and we'd be quick to say, oh, sin in the life, sin in the life. But it was a joke. We didn't really mean it. But some people think that way, that if things aren't going well for you, it's because you're a bad believer. Well, let's ask Job. Was Job a bad believer? And Demas, while he may have been popular with the cosmos, was he a bad believer? Yeah, at the end he was. He was a bad believer. Still a believer, but he's a bad believer. So, Jay, here, the pursuit of prosperity has harmed believers in their moral character. One, material motivations and economic pursuits are currently eroding the qualities of character, integrity, and virtue on both a corporate, on a personal, corporate, national, and international level. Now, do we face corporate greed? Certainly. Yes, because they have stockholders and they have to pay dividends and they want people to invest in their company. And so, yes, they have to make a profit. Everybody has to make a profit to stay in business. Profit is not a dirty word. The problem is when do the profits become excessive? And again, the another problem with that is then you got people, do-gooders in the government, who are going to fix it for us. They're going to fix the capitalist system. No, you're not. You cannot, the government cannot tell people what to buy, what to eat, where to eat, all these things that the government has gotten into trying to do. The government, and this is one of the reasons why, again, Republicans tend to not believe as much in governmental overreach. Democrats don't seem to have much of a problem with it. All of that. So, as I watch them, I recognize, well, the problems are there, sure. But the question is how to deal with them wisely as people. How do we deal with this wisely? Okay, are there people out there that cheat? Yes, there are. There are people that cheat on their taxes, certainly. But what are we to do about it? I think you just kind of have to leave it with the Lord in many cases. You can pray about it, but are we going to go out and start doing mass arrests and deportations? I think that's coming quick enough. I'm absolutely in favor of that. Let's get these 20 million people back out of here that shouldn't be here. They're illegals. They're dangerous, many of them. As you know, if you're watching the news at all, street gangs have taken over entire apartment complexes in certain cities. And in many cases, these were these sanctuary cities, these blue do-gooders, as I call them. They're going to save the world, but at what cost to the American public? This is what they didn't care about. The reality is, as far as I'm concerned, the president and the vice president were sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And they have let 20 million foreign enemies into the country. That is treasonous. And whether they'll ever do anything about it, I know that's treason. I know that that's a violation of the oath of office that you took. And then say, I can't do anything about it. And throw up your hands like it's somebody else's fault. Do you notice that these people never take the blame for their catastrophic policies and their bad decisions? It's always, Trump is an existential threat to democracy. And I like watching the news sometime, and you ought to watch some of it occasionally just to keep up with what's going on in the world around you. But I loved it the other day when they put the little White House press secretary, that little skank, who wouldn't tell the truth if it was sitting right in front of her. I've watched her stand up there and lie repeatedly. And she was asked a pretty simple question. Well, you know, Trump has been called a fascist, a Hitler, a Nazi. His followers are garbage. He's a threat to democracy. But now Joe Biden says we're going to be okay. Well, which is it? And she said, oh, you're just trying to mix things up. No, that's a legitimate question. Did that all just change on Tuesday night? Now he's no longer a Nazi? This is insane. And the fact is, all the while with this whole deal, as you have seen, with this whole deal of we just want to unite people. We just want everybody to come together. We want to turn the page. You're the page we're on. Yeah, we did turn the page. And then when I saw he won the whole thing and won all those swing states with 300 and something electoral votes, I said, yeah, that's more of a mandate to me now. Now, when they were saying it at first, I thought, that's ridiculous. That's not a mandate. You just barely won. So anyway, some believers, again, has harmed people in their moral character. The government runs on money, let's face it. And they print money. You and I are not allowed to do this. That's called counterfeiting. We're not allowed to just go print our own money. But they can. So some believers have glorified the wrong types of people in this world. Those making the most money and enjoying the highest standard of living have all too often manifested the worst character. How many scandals are you constantly hearing about? They're all the time. And many times they're involving celebrities. The people that are supposed to be, quote, looked up to. But they're not, necessarily. Well, three, as Paul indicated, the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. It is the unseen root that may yield the immoral crops of envy, jealousy, violence, theft, bribery, murder, prostitution, and other mental attitudes and verbal sins. And overt sins. People can do all kinds of things. Again, the hitman. Consider the consequences to the credibility of Lot. For choosing to settle in Sodom for the purpose of seeking his own economic advantage. Genesis chapter 13. And we have in the scriptures, as you probably know, two types of examples. Good examples and bad examples. Lot is a bad example. He is not a good example of what to be like even. Genesis 13. 10 through 13. And this is when Lot and Abraham... Abraham was told to separate from his relatives. So Lot should not be with him. But Abraham had not complied with that doctrine yet. Abraham took him with him. He took his father with him initially, Terah. And Terah decided, we're not going on to Canaan, we're staying here in Haran. And God killed him there. God has that right. He can take people out if he wants to. And if they get in the way of his plan, he's not above killing them. That's one of the things people better have a fear of God about, because I'm sure God took Terah out for Abraham's spiritual well-being, frankly. And then he ends up having, finally, and he's told him, you know, when you go out, matter of fact, you don't need to turn there, but back in 12, he says, here's the command initially while he was in Ur of the Chaldees. Essentially Babylon in that area over there. Go forth from your country. Okay, you got to separate geographically from where you are. And from your relatives. Don't take them with you. You're going to go, they're staying here. Why? Because all of Abraham's relatives, many of them were believers, but they were all idol worshipers, all of them. And they were not really in tune with the living God. And so that's part of separation. You can't have these kinds of people around you dragging you down. And go forth from your father's house. That means separate from your father. Well, he didn't initially. and you go to the land which I will show you. And again, I got to love that conversation he had to have with Sarah that day. Well, we're moving. Where are we going? I don't know. I'll know when I get there. What? I don't know that that went all that well. So they get there, though. And, of course, he still hasn't separated from Lot. But the thing that prompts this, finally, God, through a series of providential things, works this out where Abraham didn't do it himself. God worked it out for him. And for a positive believer, God can do that. Now, there's no guarantee he's going to do that. People say, well, if you've got a stumbling block, God will remove it if you're positive. He may or may not. If you're positive, yeah, there's a greater chance, I think, he will. But to guarantee that for everybody is, I think, misguided. I don't think there's any verse you can point to and says, well, if you've got a spiritual problem, God will get you over it and you don't have to worry about it. I think that's a little cavalier. I might be attributing too much to God. Verse 6 here kind of sets the stage. The land could not sustain both Abraham and Lot. They both had become very wealthy, very prosperous. Abram was rich in livestock and in silver and in gold. So they couldn't maintain it, and there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock, verse 7, and the herdsmen of Lot's. Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were dwelling then in the land. So Abram said to Lot, that there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. Better words were never spoken. That's what he should have said back in Ur, but he didn't. And this is another thing that's encouraging, I think. Even the greatest believers in the Bible didn't do this all perfectly. They had their problems. They had their failures. Abraham, as we know, had a tendency toward, he had to fight fear. That's why he ended up putting his wife in a harem, not once, but twice. Why? Because he was fearing for his life. He was afraid they're going to kill him. So Abraham struggled with fear. Isaac, he tended to be kind of the same way. He tended to be somewhat fearful and probably more of a mama's boy. Jacob, well, he was all over the place. He got the name supplanter to start with, and he fulfilled it. But you look at the life of Jacob. He's out there trying to bargain with God. God, if you bless me, then I'll serve you. Try that and see. That should be your prayer, right? God, you bless me, and then I'll serve you, but not till then. Don't expect anything till then. Now, that's the wrong attitude. And Jacob manifested it. So he said, separate from me. If you go to the left, then I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. Abraham faith rested this finally, separated from him, and just got it over with and moved on. That's all he did. And Lot lifted up his eyes. And so Lot's trying to figure, so what's Lot doing? Lot's scheming on what's best for him. That's what Lot's doing. He lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as you go to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself. Those are three very telling words right there. Chose for himself. It's all Lot's will. All the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they separated from each other. And Abraham settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley and moved his tents as far as Sodom. Oh, bummer. The men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinners against the Lord. Uh-oh. That's an ominous note. I wonder if anything will come of this. Yeah, it does. And then chapter 19, let's go see what comes of this. Chapter 19. 14. And Lot went out, and this is right after, actually, the angels finally fill him in on what's going on, back in verse 12. The two men said to Lot, who else do you have here? A son-in-law and your sons and your daughters, and whoever you have in the city, bring them out of this place, for we are about to destroy this place. Because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it. And Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters. Now, I wonder how that all went after that night where he offers the daughters to the homosexual mob. What did the boys think of that? I don't know. It probably created some tension, I would think. You offered my wife to be to what? I would think they would not be happy with Lot. But that's not the real big problem here. He said, up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be joking. They didn't take him seriously. Why? Because he'd lost credibility with them. And why had he lost credibility? Well, there's probably other factors, but his pursuit of money and the details has led him here. This is a result of his conscious choices and repeated conscious choices. And so they just thought it was a joke. I mean, and as I presume from what is said here, they never left. So they died in the conflagration that day. When God destroyed the place. So five, consider the effects of living in Sodom on the moral character of Lot and his family. Genesis 19:16. But he hesitated because when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city. But why is he hesitating? This is Titanic is going down, buddy. There's no time to hesitate. There's no time to stall here. You got to get going. And the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was on him. Now Lot, in spite of all of this, is a believer. He's a believer still. Whether his wife was or not, we don't really know. We're not ever really told that. And it was upon him, and they brought him out and put him outside the city. He had to literally be dragged out of Sodom. And yet, the irony was, when you look at a New Testament commentary on this lifestyle of Lot's, it says he was tormented by their behavior. How about moving? I don't know. Idea? If the place you live is so disgusting and degraded that it's not even healthy to be there, leave. But Lot wasn't going to leave because that's where the money was. And as security and all of that. So he didn't want to do that. So Lot 19:16, he hesitated. They drag him out. And when they brought him out, they said, escape for your life. Run for the hills. You better get out of here. Don't look behind you. And don't stay anywhere in the valley. Literally, escape to the mountains. Run for the hills or you will be swept away. But Lot said to them, oh no, my lords, you're mistaken. He's arguing with the angels now. This is Lot. Look at his character. This guy is completely out of it, spiritually. He lives in a place he can't stand, surrounded by people that are disgusting, and he won't do anything about it because he's more interested in having the money and the security and all of that of Sodom. And so then verses 30 and following, this is the final conclusion. This is what we finally hear of Lot. This is the final word we have on him. They're up in the mountains and his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar. And he stayed in the cave. And so his two daughters both get him drunk and have sex with him so they can further the family line or continue the family line. And this is where we leave Lot. A drunk incestor in a cave. That's how he ends up. That doesn't sound good. That doesn't sound like God blessing you to me at all. That sounds pretty disgusting. Thus, both the daughters, verse 36, were with child by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. You know what that means? Moab? It means from the father. That's what she named the kid, from the father. Or from my father would be even better, probably. And for the other one, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ami. For he is the father of the sons of Ammon today. Ben-Ami means son of my people. Son of my family is the idea of it. And so that the names even reflect the fact that they were conceived in less than ideal circumstances. Well, for a good example of the consequences that covetousness has upon a person's character, simply consider the inner character of Judas Iscariot, who was with Jesus for 3+ years, as all the other disciples were, John chapter 12, and saw the same teaching, heard the same teachings rather, saw all the same miracles, all the proof that he was the Messiah, the constant teaching of the truth right before his eyes. deals with the incarnate Son of God, and he doesn't get it. And part of the reason he didn't get it was because he was about the money. He's all about the Benjamins, right? That's it. That was for Lot. Or for Judas, rather. Now Jesus, six days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. And so they made a supper there. And Martha was serving, but Lazarus was one of those who were reclining at the table with him. And Mary then took a pound of very costly perfume of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. And in the Synoptic Gospels, it doesn't say which disciple did this. Only John identifies him. It says, you know, the disciples began murmuring among themselves. Well, who started it? Judas. Because Judas was about the money. Judas, one of his disciples who was intending to betray him, said, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii?" A denarii, by the way, was a basic day's wage in that time. I don't know what the day's wage is considered now. But if you're making $15 an hour for an 8-hour day, say that's $120. A day's wage then was a denarius. And 300 denarii would have been about a year's pay. He said, "Why wasn't this sold for a year's pay and given to poor people?" Well, that sounds noble. But John provides us a little bit of background through the Spirit. But Judas, now he said this, not because he was concerned about the poor, but that all sounds good, doesn't it? We're here to help the poor. That's what we're here for. But because he was a thief. And there's two terms for thief, and he was a sneak thief. He wasn't the kind of guy that, he's not a strong arm, a brigand. He wouldn't attack you on the road and take your money. He would sneak around surreptitiously and steal from the money box. He was a thief, and as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. And a part of God's plan for Messiah was for him to have an unbeliever in his midst all the time that was eventually going to betray him. This was part of the prophecies. And what does it say about the discernment or anything of the other disciples? Why was Judas put in charge of the money? I don't think they saw through him at all. They didn't get it until even that last night. Until Judas went out and killed himself, they didn't get it. Well, actually, they got it when they saw him coming up with the crowd. He came up with the arrest mob. He led them to him because he knew where he would be. So then the disciples might have figured it out. But they trusted Judas, I think, right up to the end. When Jesus said, "What you're going to go do, do quickly," there when they were in the upper room, and they thought he was telling him to go buy something or something. They thought he was telling him something else completely. They completely missed the point of what was happening. So again, you look at Judas, and he sounds good on the surface. Oh, he's all about the poor, is he? No, he's all about Judas. He's all about lining his pockets. Well, point K here, the pursuit of money, the details of life, and higher standards of living have done harm to the divine institutions of marriage and family. And this has been known for years. I remember hearing teachings on this back when I first got saved in the mid-70s. 75, almost 50 years ago now. 76. The reality is they recognized this back in the 60s, I think, even. That these things were beginning to harm the church, beginning to harm families. One, for the rewards of wealth and the details wealth can procure, many husbands and fathers are expending themselves so completely on their careers that they have little, and in some cases nothing, left to give to their families. They come home and they're exhausted. They don't have time or energy for anything. They're beat up and because they're so busy trying to make it out there in, as it were, corporate America or wherever they are. And again, there's a balance. Does God want us to work hard and be diligent? Yes. Is that all he wants us doing? No. We have actually one day a week that's a tribute to God's grace. It's called the Sabbath. It's called Saturday. This is a tribute to God's grace. He said, you don't do any work on... Now, we're not under the Sabbath. I get all this. I'm not trying to say you have to take Saturday off. You can do whatever you want with your Saturdays. I don't care. But the point is, God provided one day a week where you didn't have to work, and part of this is a tribute to grace. God will take care of you even if you're not working. It's a tribute to the fact that He provides our living grace. Every week we have that. Does God expect you to work 7 days a week? Absolutely not. No. There has to be a balance to this. You have to balance, again, the desire to get ahead and all of that with God's will and Bible class and all the other things. And the applications you need to make. And I'm very happy, you know, in that regard, when people sign up for something or they volunteer to do something, it gets done around here. This is the way it should be. Whether it's the website or set up and take down or notes or proofing or whatever all we have to do. And we don't have a lot because we, can you imagine if we had our own building, we had to cut grass and do all that other stuff? And of course, then there's all the extra bills, the utilities and stuff, and then rent or whatever. So God's really blessed us, and we're very grateful for that. And I'm grateful that people recognize this stuff, take it seriously, and apply like we should. I'm very happy about that. So, two, the physical toll and the time extracted from men often means they have little left emotionally, physically, or spiritually for their families. And the man, of course, is the spiritual leader within the household. We're going to come up on that, of course, in the Greek or the Roman household. It was the paterfamilias, and he was the head of everything. And we'll review some of that coming up here. But again, he's responsible for the whole household. That's the reality of it. The buck stops with the man. It doesn't stop with the wife. It stops with the husband. And it stops with the father. And he's the one responsible. When things don't go right, God's going to come to the authority that's there, that he put in charge. And there's two dangers with authority that you have as a husband and a father. And that's overuse or not enough. You can err in either direction. I'm not exercising the authority like I should be, and therefore my wife and kids get away with murder. That's not healthy either. Or there's the tyrant who exercises authority. I rule with an iron fist, and you aren't going to do anything without checking with me first. That's an extreme that I don't embrace. And I was raised up, really, came up through the doctrinal deal where the man's the authority, what he says goes, and if he gives you a command, no matter how ridiculous it is, you're expected to obey it. Well, I don't buy that any longer. I've jettisoned a whole lot of things that we were taught because they're incorrect. And a man, while having authority, has to learn how to use that authority properly. And that, again, the two extremes, too much or too little, they're both bad. That creates problems. Well, significant, well-rounded male leadership in the home is rare today. Many men have given themselves over to gaining and maintaining a certain standard of living. And this may stem from a man's own desire to focus on temporal prosperity. It may come from a wife who desires money in the details. Or it may stem from some misguided attempt to keep up with the Joneses. That's one of the things they always used to talk about. Why are you doing this? Well, we got to keep up with the Joneses. The Joneses are the next door neighbor that have a little more than you, see? And you got to do what they do. No. No, you don't. We don't have to orient to anything in the cosmos other than what God tells us to. And if your neighbor is more prosperous than you, who cares? I don't care. Doesn't matter. I don't care if my neighbors are prosperous. They're probably not, or they wouldn't be living by me. But I know they're probably not, because that's not a real wealthy neighborhood. But I don't think any of us live in real, real wealthy neighborhoods. Nobody's out on Longboat Key, thank God. You might not have anything left. So five, this is foolish. Since every believer should recognize the Bible is very clear on the fact that the sin nature, and that's got to be behind the lust for money and the details of life, is never going to be satisfied. Proverbs 27, I'm sorry. That's what I was trying to get out. Sheol and Abaddon are never satisfied, nor are the eyes of man ever satisfied. And so the fact is, the human race can set their sights on anything and everything. And they have. But where is satisfaction? Where is contentment? Where is gratitude in all of this pursuit? And if people were grateful and humble and content with what they have, they wouldn't be out trying to make more. Now, again, we're not talking about the legitimate desire to work hard and to be a good employee and to, if you want, grow your own business, whatever. That we're not talking about. That's a proper work ethic. We're talking about the desire to have more and more and more. Also, chapter 30, verse 15. This is one of my favorite ones. The leech has two daughters. Give, give. There are three things that will never be satisfied. And four that will not say enough. And the idea of the leech, the person that sponges off of other people, that wants everybody to give, and all of that. That's just wildly inappropriate. That's not the way believers are to live. And also, Ecclesiastes 1:8. And if you ever are feeling really upbeat, read this book. It'll bring you back down to earth. The words of a preacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Well, that could only be Solomon, but you'd be stunned at how many liberal critics say Solomon didn't write this, even though he identifies himself at the beginning of the book as the author. He didn't write it, really. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. The word means that which is empty, that which doesn't amount to much. And actually, the word able comes off of this one, which means breath or wind, a sigh even. The idea here is that everything is empty. When you look at the world and you go through everything that's out there, and we're talking about the world under the sun apart from God, everything out there amounts to nothing. It's all emptiness. And people aren't satisfied or happy, generally speaking. So as he says, all things, verse 8, are wearisome. A man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be. That which has been done is that which will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. We have different forms of technology and different things, but it's all the same old stuff. The human race has always been done. The human race hasn't materially changed. Technology has changed. Advancements have changed. Things are different. We don't live in tents anymore. We live in solid houses. We're not nomadic as much. But Abraham, once he was settled in Canaan, he wasn't really that nomadic. I mean, he moved around within the land. Is there any, that which has been is that which will be. So there's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, see, this is new? Already, it has existed for ages. And basically, he says the human race has a short memory on top of all of that. And what do we know about those who forget history, who don't remember history? They're destined to repeat it. Because they don't study history. They don't say, this has already happened before, this kind of thinking. This kind of approach to life has already been here. And Solomon, he goes ahead and proves that there's nothing out here that's really satisfying. Chapter 2 of this book. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. And so enjoy yourself. And behold, this was futility. This didn't amount to anything. I said of laughter, it is madness. And of pleasure, what does it accomplish? Take the most pleasurable thing you think you can do in life and do it, and at the end, are you satisfied forever? Nope. Nope, you'll want to repeat it. That's the nature of this. I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly, until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. And Solomon went out and exploited money and all the things it could do and lived it up. And as he says here, I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made gardens, parks, planted them with fruit trees, ponds of water to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had homeborn slaves. And I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. And I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers. Every night at Solomon's temple was like a Vegas show. They had all kinds of entertainment. Everybody would come there that he would let in, that were supposed to be there. And I had the pleasures of men, many women. Well, I think you know what he means here, right? This one's pretty evident. Many concubines. 300 wives and what, 700 concubines? Solomon had 1,000 women in his stable. Was he happy? No. No, he wasn't. And in fact, because of the violation of separation and all that, they drug his heart away. And he abandoned his God for a while. Now, history says that Solomon recovered, and it appears that he did. I think the proof of that is probably this book of Ecclesiastes. But at the end of all of this, he says there's only really one thing that's important. When all has been said and done, fear God and keep his commandments. And so Solomon went out and he did all this stuff. He pursued this and got everything anybody could want and more. There's a passage, and I don't remember where it is. It's in the Old Testament. But there's a passage that provides for you what his daily ration was just for his palace, just for the household, what all he had. And it was astonishing how much food and wine and all of that they had. All right, well, we're going to stop there. Our time's gone today. We will go ahead and continue on here Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship with other positive believers in the things of your plan. We pray that we would take these things seriously and live our lives not according to the standard of the cosmos and money, but according to the standards of your word, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. Thank you.